Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Journalists Andrew Bloom and Kerry Baraka's recent article, Sea Change, investigates the investment both Google and Meta are making in installing undersea cables to Africa. Africa's 1.4 billion inhabitants will no doubt benefit from internet access. However, the secondary consequences of Meta and Google's control of access and bandwidth could be detrimental. Joining us this morning to help us understand all of this and whether these efforts result in a net positive are Andrew Bloom and Kerry Baraka. Thank you for joining us this morning, gentlemen.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Well, you know, for us to begin to understand the differences and what's happening in Africa, I feel like it's best for you to just give us a brief overview of how the internet works here and how it's distributed in North America.
Yeah, Kerry, I'll take that one. I think the most important thing to recognize about the way the internet works really anywhere in the world is that it's entirely private networks. There is no public internet. And so you have a kind of, I like to imagine it's kind of a stack of fishing nets where you have both public, a whole range of large internet backbones or wholesale companies that are connecting disparate cities, but they kind of ride on top of each other. So one company might own the cable, the conduit in the ground. Another company might sort of own the bandwidth on that cable. But the thing to recognize is they all have to work together. They have to be interconnected with each other. So you have a Comcast connecting with a Google, you know, kind of probably two of the biggest examples. And you have local ISPs who are bringing internet to your home. But the key thing is there's this sort of interdependency where there are thousands of individual networks or independent networks that have to work together to bring the entire internet to your door. And where that starts to get interesting, of course, is when you have either monopolies in the form of cable companies, or as we're seeing more and more, the content providers like Google and Facebook no longer just providing content, but actually owning enormous pieces of the internet's infrastructure itself.
Is this kind of like the 21st century version of vertical integration, where they're trying to own more pieces of the stream that gets from their content to the individual user?
I think definitely, but it's interesting where we now have new levels of vertical integration, because it's not just about broadcast networks, but it's also about our entire two-way communication. So different from the vertical integration of a TV station owning the antennas and the airwaves, mm-hmm. And perhaps producing the content. In this case, it's in the entire platform on which we, you know, not only communicate but go to the school, access our health records, on and on and on, and all the ways that the internet is different from communications that have come before.
Now, when you look at a place like Africa, the raw potential, I think, is just so great. And so the fact that, you know, we developed all of these systems and all these integrations over time, you know, in Africa, we're going and starting kind of building this distribution system with a lot more knowledge. When companies began looking to provide Africa with internet, they started from looking at how to provide it from the air. Which companies looked into providing internet access this way, and what did they try?
The number of companies which are doing this, because like the fundamental thing was that I think with most people in Africa, it was like in the 90s, right? So like places like South Africa or Kenya, you'd have local companies, a lot of them affiliated either to like state telecom parastatals or to universities, trying to like do stuff with satellite, trying to do stuff with radar. I think like one, say for instance in Kenya, there's a company called Kenya Data Networks, which was like, it had like satellite dishes, but also like just trying to do stuff with radar. But then like the problem with this was that like, because the internet is being it's not localized, right? It's like it's data from the US, it's data from Europe. It becomes really expensive and it takes a lot of time. But then also like because it's like it's satellite and it's radar, it becomes very sensitive to like things like weather. Company like this, if like there's like something as simple as heavy cloud cover, it means that like internet access is basically lost for a while until like the cloud cover dissipates.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the laying of new undersea cables. Who's doing it and why is it so significant?
In essence, I think historically, with the internet, the laying of cables is surely the most efficient way of transmitting data. I think right now globally, 97% of international internet communication is via submarine cables, right? So you've in the past have cables being laid by huge telecom companies, either independent, single companies or multiple companies come together into a conglomerate of sorts. But in recent years, you've had companies which we think of as being content providers, content creators, coming into the cable game, right? And part of this is because of at some point in the last 5 years, the share of data that companies like Google and Meta and Amazon consumes has been rising exponentially, right? And so these companies started thinking that instead of buying bandwidth on cables owned by other people and relying on other people, why don't we have our own cable which we control fully? And so you have Meta and Facebook predominantly, and Meta has this cable which is supposed to run around Africa from all the way from near the coast of Portugal down West Africa to South Africa, and then up past Madagascar, Mozambique into East Africa, and then it's supposed to extend from East Africa all the way to India, which means that when it's complete, it will be the longest undersea internet cable in existence, which is remarkable for a company which until a few years ago was not in the business of internet infrastructure at all.
I think one of the data points that I saw that replicates kind of what you said is that it really wasn't in the picture was that, in 2010, Google, Meta, Microsoft, and Amazon collectively owned one long-distance cable. And then by 2024, they will own all or portions of more than 30. So, obviously there is, this growth in this area. When we go back to the cables, can you just give us a sense of these cables? I mean, when I think about that length that you talk about, one that's very long, but two, how thick are they? How do they get laid? What's the time frame of these?
Yeah, I always like to say that they're about as thick as a garden hose, which is not very thick at all.
Wow.
especially when you think of them in the other dimension, which is thousands of miles long. And they're laid off the back of a ship. They kind of are spooled from the factory into these enormous tanks, sort of circular tanks, and then along very specific paths that are kind of planned in advance to avoid things like underwater canyons and active shipping lanes wherever possible. And then when they get close to shore, someone actually has to kind of, bring them in a dinghy from the large cable laying ship to the beach, and they're buried on the beach and then connected to a manhole. So there really is this incredibly physical connection that stretches thousands of miles. And then, of course, the key part of the cable inside are the fiber optic strands. The current generation of cables has something like 16 pairs. They always operate in pairs with light traveling through them in one direction each. And so you have 16 strands of fiber, but then you have what really almost feels like an infinite amount of bandwidth possible because you have many different colors or wavelengths of light passing through each strand of fiber. So you have essentially hundreds or thousands of different wavelengths. And so you have a cable today that can carry the capacity that would have been more than enough for an entire country 10 years ago.
So let's talk a little bit about economics. I'm Google, I'm laying a cable. It's costing me a lot of money. How am I going to make it back?
I think this is what was really so powerful for me when I realized what Google and Meta were doing here, is that they don't need to make it back on the cable. Not only do they have this incredible cash reserves, but for them, it's all about their users and predominantly the advertising that they can show their users, which of course is an astonishingly profitable business for both of them. So what's changed and what's so dramatic is that, you know, rather than having a communications company that's in the business of charging you money for communications, you have content providers that's in the business of showing you ads. And now they are also, as a kind of, you know, almost a sort of rounding error, you know, a couple $100 million, are laying these incredibly sort of crucial pieces of infrastructure for billions, literally, of people.
So it's kind of like they're building a billboard that they can project their advertising onto, with the incidental benefit of allowing people to get other access to the internet. Am I thinking of that right?
I mean, I think one of the things that I think is so tricky when we think about Google and Meta, formerly known as Facebook, is they do have their fingers in so many different things. Google more than Facebook, of course. So I think it's difficult. There's a slippage there, certainly if you have kids in school during the pandemic, you know, Google Classroom has become completely dominant. Gmail is, dominant for email. Of course, Google Search is dominant. And so rather than just the billboard piece of it, there's a sort of, it's sort of taken over almost every aspect of our life online, in many beneficial ways. Google offers lots of excellent services and does lots of great things. But the part where I catch is that they are also quite deliberately building the infrastructure that we'll be living with for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. The whole point of the internet was decentralization. So now that we're coming to this moment where these companies, two in particular, start to look like monopolies, are we going against what this was all built for?
I think that we are certainly in a monopoly age of internet companies. One of the more interesting comments I saw about carrying my piece on Twitter was from a network engineer at an unspecified large internet company, who kind of took it for granted that these networks will not last the generation that I'm saying they will last, because both Google and Meta will be broken up sooner than that. So perhaps that's where we're headed. But certainly, the idea that Google and Meta are too big and exercise too much control is the subject of, numerous already congressional testimony. This is not a sort of fringe idea. How that changes, what happens to them, if they get the Microsoft treatment and are sort of subject of antitrust legislation in some form or another, is likely, but not definitive. But certainly, the idea that these are monopolies is not complicated. They certainly seem to act like that in many ways.
There's an implication that's floating around. It's almost underneath the water, shall we say, which is the extent to which, if Google owns the pipe, are they going to start deciding who gets to flow water through it, and are they going to really sort of deneutralize, if you will, what flows through their internet connections? What's your perspective on that?
I guess Google and Facebook's defense would be that, like, they're not, Google and Meta's defense that, like, they're definitely not going to do this, right? That it's going to be like open to everybody. But as a pessimistic person would like point out like what happened with Free Basics in India and like in all other countries where like it was operational. But actually in India, where like the Indian government is accusing them of like basically prioritizing access to certain websites, right?
Right, exactly.
Which is that like they weren't quite banning somebody from accessing like other websites, but it was free to access 36 websites, which meant that like, of course, like people are going to be more encouraged to like access those websites, most of which were affiliated with Facebook. So it's like, they might not do this, but like looking at like the history of the two companies, particularly Meta, they've been like known to like, to like, if not quite, lock out other internet providers from like their services, but like to blatantly encourage people to access their own.
And again, this isn't speculative. As you said, these programs have been rolled out, they say that this is going to be great for the communities. Meta's got free basic and discover programs. Did you say that these were rolled out in India, was it?
So a program like, say, first free basics was like rolled out in a number of countries, predominantly in Asia and in Africa. But by far, like the biggest like place was India. And this is like mostly purely in terms because of the population of India, right? So Facebook at the, like they call Facebook at the time. So Facebook like had seen that they were not gaining new subscribers in like in Europe and in the US and Canada. So they wanted like this new emerging markets, right? So when they do free basics in India, in like other Asian countries and other African countries, what they accuse of is like exactly like that of like prioritizing like access to certain sites by telling people, okay, it's free to access Facebook, it's free to access maybe Instagram, to access like something else. But what that like means, like in the countries where like there's a lot of like income inequality, is that like people who can't afford to like access like other websites, just going to like access their own sites, right? And of course, like and it had like questions about like net neutrality, right?
Yes.
And like something like Google Discover, where like it's like, okay, they're like sort of like curating the newsfeed, and it's not as big as like Free Basics ever was, but like at least a person to wonder is like they could hypothetically also like make that like newsfeed that they're creating be only things that like they want a person to see, or like only things that like bring them direct revenue.
So it's not generating business, it's generating business for them, but it's not necessarily generating business for the economies that these systems were put in place.
Let me take us in a slightly different direction, which is they're paying a lot of money, which as you say, maybe a rounding error to them, to run the cable internationally. I guess I have two questions. One is, who is going to be the regulatory authority over a cable that sort of goes between countries? And, you know, in terms of the implications we've just been talking about in terms of content control. But my second question is actually more about logistics. It's one thing to get a cable to the port in Kenya. For it to really do what we want it to do, it's got to get to individual people's homes, the so-called last mile problem. How are the Google and Facebook interacting with the infrastructure that needs to be done in Africa to actually have real people get access to the internet?
So, I mean, in essence, like it's a double salvo for them, right? Because like by being like completely like not entering the countries, it means that like they avoid like also like regulatory authorities in these countries. And like part of the problem is that like a lot of countries in Africa still don't have like policies to like guide this kind of thing. But then, like, they might in a few years, right? And so what, like, Meta and Google are doing is that, like, in certain countries, say, like, in South Africa, Uganda, they have, like, small projects to, like, connect, like, people to, like, the internet, so, like, last-mile connectivity, whether it's, like, building small terrestrial networks, either in Kampala or in Joburg, or, like, Google, I think, Google have a network in Kinshasa. What they're doing is that they're partnering with, like, existing internet companies, because like they're like, okay, to build terrestrial cable, say from the coast of Nigeria all the way inland to northern Nigeria, they're going to like have to like get like they're going to have to get licenses as like a telecom company, as like a company operating in Nigeria, which like, or like whatever country they don't want to, right? So like they partner with a local company, and like the local company like operates, like is going to like build the terrestrial like network within this country. So like one of the ones is already public, like, is a country called the company called Liquid Technologies, which is maybe the operates like the largest terrestrial network of cable in Africa, and they have a deal with Meta to like build. So Meta is going to land in Kinshasa, Meta is going to like land in Mombasa, right? So like Atlantic and Indian Ocean. So Liquid Telecom are going to like build terrestrial cable all the way from like Kinshasa through the Congo rainforest, past Burundi, Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and into Kenya. That way, Meta don't have to get licenses to operate in either of these countries.
And as a practical matter, how how, I'm just struggling with the amount of infrastructure it would take as a practical matter to get the bulk of the African population access. In other words, it's one thing to get it to the coast. How underdeveloped is that infrastructure, and how long will it take to get sort of practical access to the bulk of the population?
So, I mean, of course, it depends on, like, depends on the country, right?
Sure.
The internet condition in, like, Africa is not homogeneous. So in a country like, say, Kenya or South Africa, connectivity is pretty good. So, like, it's not like much extra needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I think, like, Kenya, I think connectivity is, like, 85%. South Africa is upwards of 90%. But then you have countries like Burundi and DRC where connectivity is, like, as low as 10%, right? And the basic answer to this is that, like, it is going to take a lot of money, which is part of why Meta and Google are doing this, that, like, they have the cash reserve to do this, right? That, like, smaller African internet companies, like, are not quite able to do. So it's, like, they have money to put into this project, and, like, they are very invested in, like, getting, like, this unconnected billion of Africa to be the new customers. And so if, like, this, and of course, like, this untapped market base is important to them, they're going to, like, put in the money into building the terrestrial network.
There's so much that we haven't been able to touch on in this interview. I was able to find your work on restoftheworld.org. We will be posting a link to that as well as we wrap up this interview. So much more, but again, you know, the ability to increase economic activity in Africa, as well as, you know, job opportunities and other pieces is vital. We've been speaking with Carrie Baraka and Andrew Bloom regarding Meta and Google's undersea cables. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
The Wasatch Center for Advanced Professional Studies, or CAPS, is a partnership between Wasatch High School students, local business, and industry mentors. CAPS students develop critical thinking and problem-solving skills by working in collaborative groups to complete real-world projects while being mentored by industry partners. Joining us this morning here in the studio is the director of the Wasatch CAPS program, Weston Broadbent. Good morning, Weston, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning.
Give us a little more background on what a CAPS program is, and how did the Wasatch CAPS program start?
You know, thanks for having me, first off. This is such a beautiful location. It's exciting to come downtown Park City. So Wasatch CAPS, what it is it's just a chance for our students to work on real-life projects with real-life people. So it's high school students. They're in their last 2 years of high school, so they're juniors or seniors. And they basically just go along, and we find an industry that they're interested in where they get to go work on a real-life project with them. And so that's kind of the essence of it. And really, if we were to go, like, one step back, the purpose of it is, as you guys know, kids are graduating college or high school and getting hired, and the owners of these companies are coming back to the schools and saying, hey, they're really good at figuring out this math equation or drawing on this program in CAD, but they're terrible at taking initiative, communicating, being leaders, having that, you know, those we call, the world calls them soft skills. We call them professional skills at CAPS. But that's kind of what really drove the program to begin, was we wanted to embed real life learning with and embed those skills into that.
And tell us how it's integrated with the curriculum. Is CAPS a course? Is it an after school activity? Explain to that a little bit.
That's a great question, Roger. It is a course. So it's a Wasatch High School course. They get CTE credit, and it's a 2-period course. And so at Wasatch, we're 8A, B day, you know, we're black and gold day is what we call it. And they take basically 2 of the periods of the 4 to be at CAPS.
Perfect. As you mentioned, there's industries or courses that CAPS looks at. What industries have you worked in before?
So the 5 areas that we focus on, because we're based out of the Heber Valley, and there's CAPS programs all over, and we can get into that later. But the 5 areas that we've focused on is business marketing entrepreneurship's one, digital design and software development's another, health and medicine's a third one, digital design, engineering and industrial design, and then agriculture and environment is kind of the fifth area.
So is this it's obviously an elective program. Are students chosen for it, or can I opt into it if I want to?
So they opt into it. Mm-hmm. And then we go through an interview process with those students to make sure that they're the right fit, that we get about 100 students a semester. We end up getting about 20% of our population from the high school. So it's a pretty successful program.
It's kind of interesting. It's sort of like a hybrid between sort of classical vocational education and academics.
Yeah.
So you're really trying to bring the two together here, it feels like.
Yeah, and one question that comes up, and maybe you guys wanted to get to this later, but is this internship idea, because a lot of people, when I talk to them, they're like, oh, that sounds like an internship. And the difference is it is kind of an internship because we're trying to expose students to this life and this world, but really, it's a project-based internship, meaning they're hubbed out of we lease some space at the UVU Wasatch campus, the high school does, and they come up to that campus, and most of their time is spent on that campus, and then sometimes they're going off-site to the business partners' locations.
So out of 100 students, how many projects come out of a typical school year? And can you give us a couple of examples of what came out of this year?
That's a really good question, too. So the typical way that we do this is we partner them into teams. So there's usually two or three students per team. So per semester, we have anywhere from 40 to 50 projects going. Each of those areas we're talking about, you know, if it's medicine and health, we would have like 10 projects in that one area per semester. So some projects continue throughout the year and some of them are semester only, but that would roughly equate to, you know, 100 to 150 projects or so.
It sounds like it takes resources, not just from the school system, but from the community to really function well. Tell us a little bit about how those partnerships with the local businesses or the local hospitals, how do you go about getting those set up?
So I didn't answer Allison's part of her question about examples, and then I'll answer your question, Roger, about the partnerships. But the other part of the question that Allison asked was, she said, what are some examples of what's going on? A couple, like, normal, and this will help understand or help you answer the second part of the question, but a couple examples would be, like, in agriculture, the DNR has come to us and said, hey, the Middle Provo River, we're wondering how healthy that Provo River is. So we go down on the Provo River. We have, you know, 15 sites we've got approved through the Reclamation Department, and our students go and pick bugs up, count bugs, because you can tell the healthiness of a river by the entomology of that river, right? And so they go through and they count how many midges and caddis, and they've created this data platform that we report back to the DNR and these fly fishing entities and everybody who's interested in that kind of that reclamation area. Does that make sense? And so
it does.
That's one example of a project that we're doing right now. And there's three students. Of the 100 students, there's, you know, 50 of those going on at any time.
What'd you do at school today? Well, I went and counted bugs.
You know, everyone's got a job to do. So as you said, like, they wanted to know the health of kind of the Middle Provo. They then figured out they had to measure bugs. At what point is the project handed over, and who decides they have to measure bugs? Like, how do they figure out how to meet the needs of the project?
Right. So the way we set it up is, my job during the summer is I go and line up projects for the year. So, and at this point, we're just finishing our sixth year at Wasatch CAP. So we've got an amazing community that supports us. We've got all these businesses who will contact me now. But at first it was kind of, you know, beating the brush to drive business. And I would go and call businesses and say, hey, would you be interested in some students running a social media marketing campaign? So as we interview students, we just finished interviewing students last week. And they come to us and they say, you know, my ideal project would be, I'm really interested in finance, or I'm really interested in doing an environment project, or whatever. And so then I go build a platform of a ton of projects, and then they come in the fall, and about the third day into our semester, all those projects come and they just pitch for 5 minutes and just say, hey, here's what we're looking for this semester. And the students choose self-select into one of their, and we try to give them one of their top options.
Sure. And then how often do they interact with that business or entity that that project is for?
It's typically on an every 2 week cycle. So every 2 weeks they'll meet with the business owner or the entity or the government agency or the mayor, you know, what, depending on the project. Like for instance, Zermatt last year had us come in and help with some social media marketing with the business end. And their marketing director at the resort would have our students come over and they would talk about starting a new TikTok, you know, campaign and what would that look like and how to kind of focus on a younger demographic because COVID had just happened and decimated their convention center, right? And so they had a kind of change and they were looking for some input from a younger demographic for their overnight stays.
That's the best people to get that from.
Exactly. It was fantastic. And the students because our students are users, but they're actually not very good at knowing how to run the business end of it, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And so to get there, and we have mentors that come along through that actually do this for a living that are willing to share with the students how it works and why they do certain things. And they'll sit down with the students and say, hey, you're starting to work on social media. You're doing an Instagram campaign. Here's how we really do it on the business side and build advertising.
So that's interesting because another element of what you're doing here is not only causing them to sort of explore the parameters of something like social marketing, but you're also teaching them about how to manage a project. Talk to us a little bit about the importance of project management.
Yeah, project management's a fascinating world. And in the project management world, essentially that's what they have become, is they become project managers, right? This group of students. And the beauty of what they're doing is we get excited because no matter what industry they go into, you're managing some sort of a project. And so we've adapted the Scrum model, which is an agility-based type of project management. And most tech companies kind of have adapted some form of that. And we had to choose one, even though we spread over a lot of industries. We had to choose one that was mm-hmm. consistent. But essentially, they're all focused on what's our end goal and how are we going to get there, right? And so embedding that long-term backward design, starting with the end in mind kind of concept and letting students really kind of go through that process in a systematic way will benefit them no matter what industry they go into.
I can't resist. Is Scrum an acronym?
I don't think so. Scrum, it's based off of, Scrum comes from the rugby So a scrum in rugby is when they all gather together. And basically, tech companies found that it was too inefficient to have these one-hour meetings every Monday morning or every day. And so they started doing the Scrum model where they would do stand-up meetings. So the meeting couldn't last more than like 15 minutes.
I want all my meetings.
And they would stand up and they would have these stand-up meetings. And they call them a Scrum Master. Would run it, and they're not like the boss per se. They're just saying, "Hey, Roger, what are you working on today? Allison, what are you got? What do we all need to help each other out with?" And they're built in these little time frames, mm-hmm. and they're typically, you know, they could range from time, but usually it's a week or two, so that you're actually getting input from your client, so that you're not building a software at the end of the day. 6 months later, and the client says, "Well, that's not even what I was talking about." So that's what kind of how it started, and we just embed it in our own version.
So we've talked about examples from the government sector. We did a hospitality one. Give us an example from the healthcare sector.
So the healthcare sector, we've got a couple of projects with them. We every semester we've got one with Intermountain Healthcare, and it will range like we right now. There was like one project that comes to mind is they did a operating room inventory. So if you were to be taken into the operating room and to go in and trying to find a scalpel or a gauze or whatever, it was kind of, you had to have worked there for a certain amount of time. And as you know, nurses have turnover and so training people up so that your operating room's running effectively mm-hmm. is kind of a challenge, right? As you can imagine. And so our students went in and helped kind of figure out how would be a more efficient way to design that operating room procedure. And it's great because they're getting real world experience in a medicine based world. The challenge is some of those students want to go and be, you know, orthopedic surgeons, but they can't go in and swing a hammer on a guy's knee and Like that doesn't work. And so with HIPAA law, there's been some challenges with this whole health thing. So we had to branch out even beyond that. And like another one we're doing right now is the ambulance. The Wasatch Fire District came to us and they said, hey, we want to know how healthy our ambulances are after we clean them. And so because biotech's this booming world, our students go in and they swab the ambulances after they Clorox them or fog them. There's a bunch of different ways they do it, and put them in petri dishes and see what grows and how healthy it is and what's more effective. And so that's another health one example.
Not to downplay the importance of these projects, but a lot of times it sounds like these projects are the ones that when you're in business, you're like, you know, it would be great if we had time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're D-list items is what we would call that. Is kind of, yeah, right? Yeah. And that's how we started when we would go out and pitch it to our clients. We'd say, hey, what is your D-list item is what we would say, right? And they would come back and say, you know, if we had time, and because they're meeting every 2 weeks with the students, it becomes a priority for them and our students, and all of a sudden it gets off the ground, right? And but what we've found is some of our clients come to us with the A-list items that are moving at A-list speed, and some of those are the best projects, and some of those turn out to be disasters, right? I mean, we've been fired from projects, we've fired clients, right? Like, you can imagine when we don't pay our clients anything, and they don't pay us. This is all just volunteer. We're just hoping, this is, the best clients are ones looking for students to have, they're giving back to the community, right, is the best clients. And the best experience for us is our students are invested into that industry. And so if it's an A-list item, like we just did one for a company called Rooney's Ice Cream, which is this ice cream bar company down in Heber. They just started. And they're these fancy ice cream bars that they're just getting off the ground, and she had the students create pitch decks to go to, you know, Splash Summit or Rio Tinto or Boondocks or whatever, and go pitch to the people who would approve whether or not they could put their little refrigerators into these locations.
I would be disappointed if the students didn't need to sample extensively in order to do a good job.
We've definitely had a lot of Rooney's ice cream this and it is very tasty. So we've had a lot of Rooney's ice cream this semester.
One thing that I noticed as I was exploring your website was that you also mentioned mentors. Are these people that are different than those that have projects?
Yes. So in our terms, and just to help clarify, we call a client someone who has a project, and a mentor someone who has an expertise that they're willing to come and give some feedback to these clients. Well, and really, like, so a case in point is Wasatch Mountain State Park came to us. There's at the Pine Creek Campground where they block the road to go up over Guardsman. And there's a kind of a nightmare parking issue for snowmobile trailers. And so they came to us and said, hey, we would love, this is a D-list item, we don't have funding for it, but we would love some students to go along and help create, you know, a better system. So Paul Berg, who's a local engineer in Midway, came to us and said, hey, I would love to help mentor those students along, give them advice. The students already have a skill in drawing on CAD. It's an engineering project, and so they already know how to use the program, but they would have no idea how to cost estimate. They would know they don't know what parking stalls typically look like, and so that whole process came through and made it happen.
That's incredible. I know that, as you said, you typically have like 45 to 50 projects, you know, per semester with 100 students. Ben Lassiter from our news department actually just put out a story, which is found on our website, and we'll definitely link it to this interview as well. But it's interviewing the students about their projects, and I think that was such a great perspective.
Yeah, if I could, I was driving up here, I was thinking, I wish I would have grabbed 3 or 4 students, because
that would be fun.
So I would highly encourage any listeners to go listen to that, because listening to the students, it sounds, you know, us adults can kind of skew things however we want, but when you listen to it from the firsthand experience of students, it's always the best.
Absolutely. So I know that there's plenty of people listening who could be mentors, who could have a project available for you. How do they get in touch with you?
So the most effective way would be on our website. There's a contact us section. If you type in, you know, your interest of your mentoring or if you have a project, then you could just click on that, send it to us. It goes straight to my email. within that day, and we'll call you and reach out to you. And I should also help clarify and give a shout out to Park City Caps. So there's a PC Caps that operates for Park City High School in a similar manner. They kind of run their program. We operate our programs fairly similarly. And we operate out of Wasatch Caps, which is the Heber Valley, and they operate out of Park City Caps. And we merge together on some projects, and we separate on others. So
things I didn't know. Appreciate it. We've been speaking with Weston Broadbent. He is the Wasatch Caps director. Weston, thank you for joining us this morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
In February 2020, Warren Buffett appeared on CNBC and stated, cryptocurrencies basically have no value and they don't produce anything. They don't reproduce. They can't mail you a check. They can't do anything. And what you hope is that somebody else comes along and pays you more money for them later on. But then that person's got the problem. In terms of value, zero. Kind of like the P.T. Barnum approach to finance. Anyway, last week, there were some pretty dramatic developments in the cryptocurrency world. I didn't understand it then. I don't understand it now. But joining us this morning to help us understand the cryptocurrency crash is Jesse Pound, a CNBC reporter. He spent some time with us last July where he really helped give us an overview of cryptocurrency. Jesse, thanks for joining us this morning, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hello, it's good to be back.
So, Jesse, let's start with what happened last week. Cryptocurrency is historically volatile, and there were plenty of real victims of last week's crash. Let's talk about what the UST crash meant. What does it mean that UST crashed?
Great. So UST, or I'll call it Terra here a couple of times because that's just easier to say, was a type of stable coin. And the stable coin, as you can understand from the drop here, is a bit of a misnomer. Mm-hmm. But basically, the way to look at it is a lot of the popular cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are actually kind of inconvenient to like actually transactions in and trade. And so these stable coins sort of serve as the grease for the wheels of crypto. Terra was this stable coin that was backed, in air quotes, by an algorithm, basically a trading mechanism, a perpetual motion machine, if you want to be a little bit more critical. And basically what happened is that broke down and created a death spiral where both Terra and its sister coin, Luna, are now effectively worthless. These are pretty large crypto projects, not as big as Bitcoin, but very, very large. And it just sort of contributed to a general lack of confidence in the crypto market that exacerbated a sell-off we were already seeing that sort of went along with the stock market declines.
So just as you said, Luna and Terra are not the same as Bitcoin, yet Bitcoin's activity Luna and Terra's activity did impact Bitcoin. Can you give us a sense of the types of losses seen and the reaction that the cryptocurrency investors had last week?
Great. So the total losses in the crypto industry from like a paper wealth perspective appear to be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Those calculations are a little fuzzy to me, so I hesitate to get any more exact than that. As far as the reaction to different investors, I think it's helpful to think of it in three groups. One group is sort of the crypto true believers who've been there for a long time now, and crypto has had big dramatic pullbacks in the past, and so those people are probably likely to just see this as another bump in the road. But to hang on. Then you have institutional investors. A couple weeks ago, Fidelity announced that they were going to play around with allowing people to put some of their 401k in Bitcoin, for example. Institutional investors have just started to dip their toes into crypto. And a big pullback like this is likely to at least pause that for the time being. And then the people who are probably most hurt by this are the people who've joined in the past year or two, you know, more retail-oriented investors who sort of jumped in 2020 when crypto and NFTs sort of had a big moment culturally. And those are the people that have probably been hurt the most by this because they bought so close to the top of the mm-hmm. levels. They've likely seen pretty substantial losses. And so if you see some stories from people who went a little too far in on their personal accounts and lost a lot of their savings, it's likely somebody who got it fairly recently here. And that's pretty sad.
You know, it's early to predict whether this is, as you say, a blip or the beginning of a sea change. But one of the things I was curious about is I know that I've read stories over the last year where some publicly traded companies have put some assets into crypto. Are we going to see people forced to make disclosures this week because of the size of these losses?
It's possible. It's one of the ones, companies that already did this is a software firm called MicroStrategy that has really sort of pivoted to being a de facto Bitcoin traded public stock because it's invested so much and took out debt to invest in Bitcoin, actually. And they've already disclosed, like, previous quarters, sort of like what their cost basis is, and sort of what would trigger like a margin call or something like that. So I don't know that we'll see additional disclosures anytime soon. But if Bitcoin were to fall even further than it is now, it's trading a little under $30,000 today, it could get to the point where a company like MicroStrategy or someone else it is really put under pressure based on their Bitcoin holdings.
Pardon me. So what happened last week? And as well, the Federal Reserve put out a May 22 financial stability report. Both of those pieces together, I think, shows risks of stablecoins to those of the money market funds, that and saying that they're very similar to the money market funds that played a key role in the 2008 financial crisis. Can you talk about some of those similarities and or the differences that we saw with regards to what happened last week and the 2008 crisis?
Sure. There are a lot of surface level similarities. These stablecoins do sort of work like money market funds did, where just the super liquid asset, it's easier to trade and is effectively, and some people in the industry view it as effectively cash. Some good news is that these stablecoins aren't as intertwined with our, you know, regular financial system as the money market funds were. So there's less risk of contagion in that case. Another thing is for Terra specifically, it didn't really have any assets backing it because it was supposed to hold its peg through this trading mechanism. There is another stablecoin called Tether that briefly lost its $1 peg, though it's bounced back. And that is more in the traditional money market fund. And it's sort of murky what its backing actually is. So where the money market funds went down because the debt that was backing them, you know, declined in price very rapidly. That's not a great analogy to Terra and Luna, but the money market funds comparison is pretty close.
Yeah, it is really interesting. You just touched on something, which was that the money market funds actually had assets underneath them. Mm-hmm. What is it that made Terra worth the buck in the first place? I mean, you know, without any underlying asset, was it basically, did somebody come out and say, I'm worth a dollar because I say I'm worth a dollar?
Yeah, that's part of it. It's partially a lot of marketing, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So the Terra coin was attached to Luna, which I called it sister coin. And basically Luna was the coin for a network. A lot of these cryptocurrencies are sort of built on different blockchain networks with different rules and protocols. And so the basic idea was that you could trade, you could always trade in your Terra, your UST stable coin, for $1 worth of whatever Luna was
trading at
Luna's market price. And so Luna was supposed to be this free trading thing. But the problem is that Luna also fell down. And once Luna also fell below a dollar, then it would create more Luna, but it would just push the price further and further down to where both were effectively driven to zero.
Just trying to comprehend all of this, honestly.
An event like what we're seeing going on has got to once again create calls for some kind of regulation. What do you think is going to happen on the regulatory front, if anything?
Right. Well, as Allison mentioned earlier, there was already some focus from regulators to focus on stablecoins in particular as a area of concern, both because, like I said, it's sort of a misnomer with the name, obviously, in that. That raises concerns for consumers, and then you also have the fact that these blowups can sort of ripple into other parts of crypto or even into hedge funds and capital funds. So I think this will only sort of sharpen that focus on stable coins. But it'll be interesting to see how much power the U.S. regulators can have over some of these companies that aren't based in the U.S. And the hedge funds who might also not be based in the U.S. So that'll be a little bit of some difficulty here. But it definitely will lead to greater scrutiny, and I think you'll see some of the institutional investors who maybe got burned here a little bit, sort of push Washington along in that direction.
That makes some sense. We've been speaking with Jesse Pound. He's a CNBC reporter. He's been with us here on Mountain Money before, and as just like today, he helped us understand a bit more about cryptocurrency. Jesse, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.